This is a production of Cornell University.
Salix? Salix? Block? Breeden? Brown? Chopra?
Yes.
Desai?
Desai?
Yeah. Francisco? Adam Gitlin?
Here.
Ross Gitlin?
Excuse.
Goldberg?
Here.
Gorjani?
Yes.
Hoffman?
Here.
Kay?
Here.
Lee?
Excuse.
Miller?
Yep.
Mueller?
Here.
Muir?
Here.
Nicoletti?
Here.
Pinckney?
Here.
Patel?
Here.
Rapp?
Here.
Rao?
Yes.
Gelfo?
Here.
Zolman?
Make sure that's in a minute.
Schaffison?
Yeah, alright.
Wolford? Yatarian?
Here.
Very good. Robert? Santanglo?
Here.
That's all.
Oh.
Moving on to the approval of the February 23rd meeting minutes.
We are going to have to postpone them until next week because I have to send it out next week.
Okay, so that will be postponed next week. Moving on to open microphone, is there anyone in the audience that here has would like to make an announcement? That's not already out there yet, so before we begin with our first presentation by Mr. DeMarco, Mohit specifically to a very brief
announcement. Great. So, SA, for those of you guys who don't know yet, WVVR is going to be covering our meeting from now on. They're going to provide us a full live streaming of our SA meeting, and in addition, I like clips afterwards. There's Matt with the handheld in the audience who is here at WVVR. Matt and Rouge will be at most of our meetings this semester, so get to know them. So, we'll go talk to them. And in addition, they also want to help us out with PRing our own initiatives through different channels to the IFIC community. So if you have anything you want to get specifically to the IFIC community, please do reach out to me and I'll Matt for
okay, great. So we're going to move on to our first presenter, Joseph DeMarco. If you'll come to the front. And also, DJ, I know you're the one that... Robin, so if you would like to say a few words.
Yeah, sure. So, Joseph did say about some fire safety initiatives that they have already taken and some plans for the future. He had some sheets that, about posters that we can hang and some things on the Facebook page, which we should all have liked. And, now he's just going to talk about his department a little bit more and some things that we can do to get the word out.
Yeah, I want to thank you for inviting me. We, EH&S Fire Safety, deal with the subject. It's not very sexy, but it's very important. And we're, over the years, we've been trying to reach out to the students. We do have a fire problem that's not very well publicized. You all know about the fatalities we've had off campus in the last several years. Within the last couple of months, we've had a couple of fires in, one is in a dorm room, one was in a fraternity, caused by candles, things that are avoidable. And so we're trying to extend our outreach, if you want to use that phrase. And I've got some history on the employee assembly, and I thought, if any way to reach students, the student assembly. So last semester I met with Ulysses, who then took off to Rome, and we were going to be in the C4 event. It was a 4-seat C4. And that got postponed. So hopefully when it happens in the spring, we'll be part of that again. You have in your packets some black and white copies, and I also sent around some color editions of some of the postering that can be used to try to get the message out. My idea of connecting with whatever your safety committee or whatever you want is to use your knowledge of the students and how students interact to get the message out. C4 is just one way of doing it. I spoke with EJ about it, that we have a Facebook page. In fact, if you want to get on Facebook, you can probably find it. that we're hopefully going to be using to connect with students and get our message out. If those of you are looking for it, it's Cornell EHS Fire Safety. I'm working on getting the little chiclets out, but I haven't got that far yet. One thing at a time. And so we want to use that, and hopefully we'll work with your safety committee on better ways of using it. I'm an old fart. I don't really know how this works. I see everything's going viral on Facebook and all that, and I've got to tap into that somehow. I'm working with a fellow down in Day Hall on how to hook things up. He's giving me some ideas, but you guys know that stuff so much better. And I'm not doing the Twitter thing yet. But using the Facebook in however it can be used is something I'm looking for you guys to give us ideas. Show us how to do it. We know the information. We can use. There's a lot of stuff out there that we can funnel through Facebook to the students. We're looking at it in two different facets, is on campus and off campus. Now, we've just recently been included in the first off-campus email newsletter. I'm excited about that. We're going to continually put things out to the off-campus group. And we have to work with the fire department on that because technically it's off-campus. We don't have control of that. On a campus, we do all we can to keep track of the places. And we put a great amount of effort into making sure our equipment works, the equipment's there. And we have a good track record. We really do. Just as a little side note, our number one fire problem in our residence halls. Cooking. Unattended cooking. People start stuff, and they go back on the computer, or they get on the phone, they forget about it, and all of a sudden, there's smoke and there's fire. Fortunately, most of the time our building equipment takes care of it, so the incidents are small. The candle problem. See, we've for years tried to use RAs as our conduit to the students, and that has shown to be haphazard. Some really do a nice job, and some just kind of, they got so many other things on their mind. So we're trying to use whatever we can to get directly connected with the students. So I'm looking forward to working with your safety committee and doing whatever works best for you guys. And like I said, you guys know how to get to each other. And using whatever the social media is, if an event happens, people start questioning through the Facebook or whatever, we can get the information. This is what really happened. This is how you can avoid it again, and so forth. Does this kind of stuff make sense? A lot of nodding heads. Do you have any ideas right now that you might want to tell me? I mean, we're looking at doing some special events, maybe including the fire department in the future. Maybe we'll bring a truck up on Hope Plaza or something. Use that as a drawing card, things like that. Yes?
I'm a little for college tab, for example. Is there a policy about and for on-campus housing and I guess some off-campus facilities also? Is there a policy where the fire alarms, when they go off, automatically go to police?
Okay. Well, you open it up. We'll talk about it. The on-campus buildings, all of Cornell buildings, even though the fraternities at Cornell buildings. We have no sororities right now. All of our fire alarm systems, including this building, are connected to Barton Hall. The alarm goes to Barton Hall. They notify us and the fire department. Technically called a central station setup. That's the way it works. All campus buildings are connected to the Tompkins County 911 set up at the airport. So any of the off-campus fraternities or housing units or whatever, it goes to them. So that brings us into the other way of a little education. How to report an emergency. You're using the phone. Using a phone as part of the Cornell system. You dial 911 or push 911 now. Right? It goes directly to Cornell Police. If you use a cell phone, 911 goes to the Tompkins County 911 Center. So what we've been trying to impress on students, and don't do it now, is that they program the Cornell Police number 255-1111 into their phone as their emergency number. That way, we're going to get it right away, and we'll be on our way. Now, we monitor their frequencies with their little pagers here, we're up right now. But sometimes we don't get it firsthand, especially like during athletic events or wrestling camps. We'll hear the ambulance going to Barton Hall. Well, I got to go now. Whereas if it directly goes to Cornell Police, we'll get it firsthand. So these are the kind of things that we can use, whatever conduit we can to get it out to the students. Did I answer your question? Yes.
What sort of collaboration stands right now between, a lot of what we talk about on the student assembly here, we like to push together health and safety into one big category. And that includes a lot of work that we do with Gannett.
Right.
I know that Gannett has a really nice, they put out little informational sheets that go into the bathroom stalls that mm-hmm. you find all over the residence hall and sort of like that. I was wondering if there was a place right now that exists that you all come together and sort of talk about shared promotional techniques and things like that. In my head, that seems like a great way that you guys could.
It is, and I'd like to say we already have it in. But if we did, you'd see our things in the bathroom stalls too.
Yeah.
So it's an area where we can look for it. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Don.
Hi, thanks for coming. Just in regards to spray information, I know in the beginning of the year, the CUPD or some police personnel come to the North Campus and talk to freshmen, have them, just show them the consequences of underage drinking, for example. They'll put on the glasses and have them try to walk the straight line, stuff like that. So maybe you can ride a fire truck up to North Campus at some point and just talk to freshmen,
unfortunately, we don't have the advantage. Cornell Police has two people, that's their job. We don't have that luxury yet. But your idea is great. What we'd like to also do is maybe have you guys be the ones that come. Have resident hall meetings. We have staff enough now that you could set it up. We could go to residence hall in the evening and meet with them and discuss things, as well as have other events. But we need to partner with somebody to get it going.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are, to me, the logical direction to go.
Great.
Representative Hi. Thank you. Sorry. Thank you so much for coming. This is, I guess, a side tangent to something you mentioned as far as, the room safety checks go, but this is actually something that others have asked me, and I haven't really been too sure about. I know when you go in there, you're looking for lamps or extension cords or stuff like that are fire hazards. I guess, to what extent are students privy to, their own privacy and, their own, contents of the room that they either, don't want people seeing or do want people seeing, or things they put in closets and stuff like that?
Well, you're in an area that's not my real area of expertise, but the inspections that get done are looking for certain obvious hazards.
Mm-hmm.
They're not into probe for other information.
Okay.
And so, they see overloaded circuits, or they see extension cords, they're going to pick that out, and they're not going to go prying through looking for other stuff.
Okay.
It's not their goal. Their goal is to get the stuff that's pretty obvious that can be corrected and so forth.
Cool.
Representative Garzani?
Yes, I was just curious, since I was coming about maybe a timeline you guys have in mind of how to engage students, when it comes to going to residence halls and things like that. I think it's difficult to get students to go to a mandatory meeting after the first 2 weeks of school, because after that, everyone's kind of found it. They've got their scheduling. The cool kids kind of know what they can skip out on and don't go
ahead. Well, that's why we were looking at you guys, because you guys know your schedule. I know what Slope Day is, I know what Dragon Day is, that kind of stuff. But you guys would be the ones that could help direct us to the best use of our time and your time. So that's what I'm excited about working with the Safety Committee on doing that.
Great. Representative
Zellman? How expensive is signage? I vaguely remember in the kitchen or something, but I feel like to some extent the reminder has to be just as you're potentially engaging in that hazard inspection. So what's the current status of signage in the
city? Again, I would have to say
haphazard.
Okay. This is one of the reasons I'm bringing these out, so these examples can be used. And in the fall, with the RA training, the last 2 years has gone to more of a panel discussion with RAs and bringing things up. And again, we don't have the staff to follow up and do all of this stuff. Whereby, as this suggested, maybe we can get together with Gannett and work on that. We were going to do a program where we put stickers on the back of the doors, like they do in a lot of them. That hasn't been followed up yet. But you're right. We need to get more actively pushing these things out there. And so if you guys, I'm not sure how you have it set up where your representation is, but if you've got representatives in the residence hall, we can use them to say, hey, this is a good thing, put it up, the holidays are coming, and that kind of stuff. It's a great idea.
Next on the speaker list.
Hi, I'm actually an RA in Balt Hall. So I was curious about, I know you mentioned like as far as like reaching out to residents and speaking to them as far as like not leaving candles and like being mindful. How else would you recommend that we reach out to them? Because we can't necessarily like go in their room and make sure that they don't have these things, such as candles and lamps, unless they are comfortable calling to use them.
It's a sticky situation. There was, I mean, if you're walking by, you see it. That's one thing, but you probe it in there. I guess the best thing is just to kind of stress the dangers. I can, we'll be contacting you with other areas to go, not just our Facebook page, to get the information out. There's some things out there that are a little more hardcore than other things, but there's ways of doing it, and the hazards are there. And keep bringing up examples, like some of the recent incidents with candles causing fires in our building. That kind of stuff can be shared without saying names and stuff.
And as far as, I know somebody mentioned programs. I know we in Baltimore last semester, we actually had a fire safety program, and that the residents found it very helpful. So maybe we can reach out to like the different RHDs of the dorms.
That would be great too. We need to get actively involved before we have a disaster. That's one of the problems is that once you have a disaster, everybody gets all excited about it. Because that's a little history, if you're interested in it. 4567, March 4th, 1967. There was a fire in what is now Ecology House. We had 9 fatalities, 8 students and a faculty advisor. That fire itself is what started the New York State Office of Fire Prevention Control and we were then called life safety. But that was a disaster that caused the people to almost pay attention to it now. And so we're trying to work so we don't have that again.
Next one, the Representative
Patel. So thanks for coming. Just one thing I thought of maybe is that if you could do something sort of in collaboration with fire drills, because typically those just entail, people just leave their dorms, then they're just standing outside. And I think just that sort of moment when everyone in dorms sort of like grouped together, just waiting outside, they don't really have much to do, that'd be a great time to educate about fire safety.
You're right about it having to be a captive audience. That would be something where somebody in the student area could follow through. So generally when we're doing those kind of drills, we're trying to knock them off. So the one building, next to them. So if get them out there and you guys can't step out, that's a great idea. But we just don't have the staff to do that. And we have to, by statute, do so many drills a year and have to do them between certain hours, and we just got to keep going building. But I like the idea of having they're all in one place. Yeah.
To comment on that, is it possible that before you do the fire drills, you alert the RAs to create a program that when the students are...
Fortunately, they have to be unannounced.
Okay. Even are the RHDs aware of the fire drills?
We publish a schedule of what period we're going to be around. Mm-hmm. And that's about the best that I can say we do. Okay. It's coming up. So what did you say? Yeah. We have to do residential drills 4 times a year, and they have to be unannounced. Of course, if you see us in the area, what's coming. But there's certain areas now. If you want, I can send the dates. They're coming up. Obviously, they're going to happen at the beginning of the school year, and once we get in the spring. But they're coming up.
Just to follow up on that, in the time period when you tell them that they can do fire drills, that you're going to do a fire drill, are the RAs provided with supplementary materials? Just because I know my freshman year, during a lot of the fire drills, like everybody just kind of went outside, went back in, went back to whatever they're doing, not thinking about what could actually happen. And I think that's a really great frame for you to inject a lot of these thoughts.
You're both on the same page here, yeah.
Okay.
So we need to get together on that and say, all right, what can we do? Is a handout what you want? See, we used to do, at the beginning of the school year when registration used to be, before anybody did applying, when they used to go up to the athletic building to register, we used to hand out envelopes full of all kinds of donations. And they all got thrown in the can. So we stopped doing that because we waste money, waste trees. But you're right, that's an opportune time. We just need to coordinate it and get through communication to you and what would be a good thing to get out.
All right, that's the end of the speakers. Does anyone else have any more questions or anything else?
Thank you for coming, and again, we look forward to working together.
All right, so next, we have a presentation by Okay, so before we go into our next speaker, we're going to skip through the agenda and go to announcements and reports. The first is an article announcement by Rob Caitlin and Chris Thomas.
Hi, everybody. So for the past several years, freshmen and representatives have been trying to get garbage cans on North Campus. Adam promised that a few years ago. And this past week, both Ross and myself had the opportunity to meet with Spring Buck, who is the self-proclaimed recycling guru of Cornell, and Pete Salino, who is in charge of grounds for the campus. And what they're doing right now is they're going through a reassignment of all garbage cans on campus. So what they're doing is they're slowly removing garbage cans and seeing if they're needed in certain locations and then reassigning them. As of right now, the three garbage cans locations that we all approved last semester will be, they'll happen by the second week of April. They are weather depending, so they said that it could be up until the last week in April, but they're shooting for Earth Week, which is the week before Earth Day, which this year or every year is the 22nd of April. So it's really exciting, and we're finally going to have a garbage can at Helen Newman Hall, the intersection of Dixon, Domlin, and Court, and then at the top of the steps at Walsh.
Great. Great job. It's been a long time coming, and it's really gotten us fired up about it. So we're excited to see it happen for you.
And Spring Buck wanted us to come up with a way to promote Recycle Mania, which is Cornell's initiative to keep on recycling. So, and one last thing, they're getting, Spring Buck is working on getting approval to have the student assembly's name on the three garbage cans.
Perfect. Good job. Thank you for the announcement.
Hey guys, just a brief update. So next week the trustees will be on campus for their March meetings. There's going to be a number of times when students are involved in it, which I'm really excited about. Just about every day there'll be something involving students. The only real announcement part of it is, as always, part of the meetings are held in open session, which means that any outsider is allowed to come in. It's something that a lot of people don't take advantage of. So if you're interested in seeing the inside workings of the Board of Trustees, at least for a little bit, feel free to shoot me an email and let me know. The one that I think most people would be interested in is the full board meeting, which is on Friday morning, and the open session will feature a report from President Scorton, a report from President Raps, and a report from President Cortez of the GPSA. So if you want to come and see that, email me, and just something to look for next week.
Statler, Western.
It's the auditorium in Stadler in the first floor. I don't know the room off the top of my head, but if you email me, I have it.
Right.
Pardon?
It's not the
big auditorium. It's called the amphitheater.
It's around the corner from Regent.
Yeah, that's the best description of it. I'll email it out. Let's put
Great.
It that way.
Thank you. Yeah, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to go over what I'm reporting to the Board of Trustees. It's basically a similar document to what I was sending to President Scorton. I'll be sure to send that out to all of you before it gets sent to the board. So thank you. All right, an Asian Night announcement by Vice President Fauci.
All right, hi everyone. Coming up this weekend, we have a booth at Asian Night, the event run by Catholic. We are putting together booths. The theme of the night is traditional games, so we're putting together a game with Cornell Trivia. Me and Stephen Breeden are working on an OBLA fund, which will also be paid to apply from our booth. So we need you guys to sign up. I sent out the sign-up sheet again today in the list of events that are coming up this week. So again, sign up. It's by hour from 8 to 1. So currently up to later hours, 10. All right. Looking forward to seeing you guys there. And if you have any questions or things to add on the regular outreach calendar, always let me know.
I'm an guitar update by myself. So I sent this all out to you earlier. I'm going to start opening up to the regular Cornell community and for people that I think would be interested. But basically, we need at least one or two leaders on the Ithaca campus to be the Ithaca ambassador to all the medical students at guitar that will be coming over for the summer. If you're here over the summer, you know you have about a couple hours a week to plan events, connect them with administrators and Syracuse, show them the local Ithaca region. They'll be more than happy to show you their own culture. It's kind of an exchange between our two campuses. And normally there's a trip to the bar for those people that are really involved. So if you're really interested, talk to me really soon. We need to find people to are part of it. In the next couple weeks, and I'm working hopefully with the ISSO director to really institutionalize it since it seems a bit, it was started a couple years ago and they haven't really gotten that administration backing yet. So let me know if you have any questions.
Also, as a side note, if anyone is thinking about spending the summer in Ithaca, it's a great experience. I spent last summer, so did John. There are a lot of great things to do. It's really beautiful, and I caught up with credit.
And you can be an Ithaca guitar ambassador. So, thanks so much. All right, next announcement by Representative Brown.
Oh, hi guys. In case you haven't seen posters or heard yet, we have a guest speaker coming and soon somebody sponsored the event under the Women's Issues Committee. Her name is Rachel Lloyd. She founded GEMS. It's a nonprofit in Harlem, New York. It's the first of its kind to combat CSEC, which is the commercial sexual exploitation of children in the New York City area. She'll be presenting in Call Auditorium from 7 to 8 next Tuesday. There will also be a book signing following the presentation at 8 o'clock. So come with questions, purchase a book, get it signed, talk to her about the issue. She's actually a victim of sexual exploitation in Europe, and she found that there weren't adequate laws here when she came here. So she founded GEMS. She found that over 300,000 girls are sexually exploited a year in America. And GEMS is just the only nonprofit that combats it in New York, and it's really, it's increasing and the age is decreasing, so it's a big issue, and it's a big issue on a lot of legislature plates as well. There's been a lot of laws passed these plates. So that poster, you can see postering, I have quarter cards, and I'll send you a reminder if you listen, and please send it out to any listeners you think would be interested.
Great work for all of the
community. Oh, also, sorry, Sasha and Tia gave me this today. Erica Hudgens, she's coming to speak. She's a former political prisoner and leader in the Black Panther. March 27th at 7, if you're interested in posting for this as well. I think it'd be an awesome event. She has some great stories to tell, and yeah, she's very influential figure.
Great. Next, a brief update by Hannah Geiger.
So right now, this past weekend, we were all at a conference in Hartford, Connecticut, representing our community, and our community was awarded 2 awards, which was great, but as of right now, there's no other new policies or changes there.
And on behalf of the Director of Elections, Margaret, just a quick election update. Elections start Monday. What? Voting starts Monday. We're going to be having voting booths all around campus, hopefully to get some more people to vote. Keep campaigning. Everyone who's campaigning, good luck. And we'll know by next Thursday the new seats for next year, which is very exciting. So with that, that's the end of announcements and reports. Does anyone else have another announcement and report they'd like to make? All right, seeing none, we're going to go back to Section 5. Melissa has agreed to present us about Title IX. She's the chair of the University Assembly, a very friendly face to FA. And we actually right now want to have everyone participate in the Google Doc So what we're going to do right after Melissa finishes her presentation is Adam's going to email out the Google Doc where everyone should put a couple notes about how they questions or how they feel about the policies that the UA is recommending. We have to bring them to the UA in 2 weeks about how the essay receives all of these changes, and I need your feedback. We're going to take a couple minutes afterwards to make sure that everyone does do this, because it will be mandatory after you listen. So please listen carefully. There's a lot of supporting documentation that was emailed out, and you can look on it on your computers and in your documents as well.
Okay, so I don't know if many of you guys know what's going on with the code of conduct and everything, but yeah, like she said, I made a report on like the code of judicial committee and what they're working on right now. Is issues dealing with Title IX. So Title IX is like it relates to civil rights laws, and I guess last year in April, beginning of April, there was a letter sent out. It's called like a Dear Colleague letter. And they gave guidance to universities like ours that receive federal funding on how they need to comply with Title IX and recommendations for that. So some of the main points that were highlighted in that letter were that the code of conduct needs to allow for third parties to file a complaint on the behalf of the student, and that third party doesn't necessarily need to be part of the Cornell community, that both parties need to have equal rights or equal appeals, that the standard of evidence needs to be lowered to preponderance of evidence. Right now it's clear and convincing, and that there needs to be a shorter time frame between whenever it's brought to the, whenever the issue is brought forward and whenever a decision is made. So at the end of last year, the University Assembly made an amendment to the code of conduct that was supposed to be just for a short period of time, just so they could fix it, and that the university want to be in a position where they could possibly have a lawsuit filed against them. But that was made under the condition that this year more changes would be made that would be more permanent. So right now the code of conduct, there's two options. There's the code of conduct and the policy 6.4. Policy 6.4 relates to everyone but students, whenever a student is accused. So with the 6.4, so the difference between 6.4 and code of conduct, sorry, is the code of conduct has a hearing board that hears cases, whereas the 6.4 uses Office of Workforce Policy and Labor Relations. And then for it to go into the code of conduct, there'd have to be you'd have to fully change the code of conduct in order to make it compliant to Title IX. And with the hearing, another thing about the hearing board is that if an issue is brought forward, the hearing board would have a difficult time trying to get the process through in the time period that the Dear Colleague letter recommends. And then with 6.4, it's faster because you are going through the Office of Workforce Policy and Labor Relations, and it's also more private because you don't have students on the hearing board as you do in the code of conduct. The really strong point about the code of conduct, though, is that right now it's there's the way it's written is so that there's balances of rights and there's protection of the rights of the accused, and 6.4 currently does not have that protection that the code of conduct does. So that's a little bit of the background information. In your agenda packet, you have Resolution 6, which is also being called Appendix A whenever we're talking about Resolution 7. So Resolution 6 is four main points that are changes to the Code of Conduct, and those four points are points that the University Assembly and the Closing Judicial Committee see are important to change the Code of Conduct no matter what. And I'll get back to how that relates to Resolution 7 after I go through this. But Resolution 6, it makes it so that there's members of the hearing board that are trained specifically to deal with sexual harassment and sexual abuse cases that would the 6.4 process would already have. It has a clause in it where the victim or the accused may ask for a hearing panel composed of faculty members and employees drawn from the pool so that there aren't students on it, because that was one of the things that we saw an issue right now at the hearing board, because it makes the victim, usually women, feel uncomfortable bringing something forward. The next point is to avoid intimidation through the questioning. It changes it so that it's more private and that so that the cross-examination of the complainant or victim has to be written down and read aloud to the witnesses if the witnesses request it. And then the last point is that the witnesses of the case would not hear the evidence presented to the hearing, whether that be a police report or anything else, and that the only time that they would hear that information would be if the hearing board determined that it was appropriate. So those are the changes to the code of conduct that we see absolutely necessary. Now, Resolution 7 has not gone through the University Assembly yet. It just went through the Code of Judicial Committee, and it passed in the Code of Judicial Committee. It was brought up at our meeting on Tuesday, but very briefly, just so that the University Assembly basically understands what's coming and prepare to know everything about it for the following meeting on March 13th so that we can discuss it fully.
So this is the one that passed CJC?
Yeah.
Resolution 7.
Okay, so Resolution 7, the whereas part for the first, I believe, 7 points is giving a little bit of the background information that I just presented. And then it goes into how, then it explains that the Code of Judicial Committee and the University Assembly would want the rights in favor of the accused maintained unless it's determined not compliant to Title IX, according to the president and the advisors. And going off of that, it's saying that the Code of Judicial Committee and if it passed in the University Assembly, that we would want the sexual harassment and sexual abuse cases to stay in the Code of Conduct unless, again, it's determined not compliant. And by staying in the Code of Conduct, I mean it would still have Resolution 6, the changes that were made by Resolution 6 in that Code of Conduct. And then the Be It Therefore Resolved part is recommending that the changes made at the end of last year are removed because those will no longer be relevant. And that there's two options. Either you leave sexual harassment and sexual abuse in the Code of Conduct with the changes made by Resolution 6, but if that does not comply, then you put in sexual assault and sexual harassment cases into 6.4, and that's under the condition that administration would completely overhaul 6.4 and make it applicable. And there's also a part of that that says that the University Assembly would have a say in what those changes to 6.4 are. The reason that we see that the University Assembly needs to have a say in the changes to 6.4 is to make sure that the protection of the rights of the accused is maintained, and that there is that element, and that also the elements of Resolution 6 are put into whatever the changes of 6.4 are. That's that.
So the speaker's list is open, but just to clarify before we open up the speaker's list, because this is a lot of
confusion. It is, and I probably was a little confusing.
No, it was good. So there are two resolutions that are basically in front of the UA for your March 13th meeting.
No, Resolution 6 already passed in the University Assembly, and that is changes to the Code of Conduct. And also another thing is that if Resolution 7 passes and that the President determines that sexual harassment and sexual abuse have to go into 6.4 in order to be compliant with Title IX, then Resolution 6 would still be in, or would still like take effect in the Code of Conduct while they're rewriting 6.4, because that's going to take a while as well. And so there needs to be something in place that's protecting these rights and everything.
So between these two, which do you think is going to be the most likely course of action? To change the Code of Conduct, which is already in place for students, but to keep it as separate, we have 1.4 to 6.4, we only have non-students who are trained in doing sexual assault making decisions, or having Resolution 7, which is changing 6.4, but taking it out of the campus study context.
So from what we've been hearing through the people that, through like Mary Beth Grant and the people that work with this more closely with the president, is that it's probably going to have to go into 6.4 in order for it to be compliant and in order to not have to completely change the code of conduct. And there are certain elements of the code of conduct that would have to be changed that we wouldn't want changed. So most likely it'll go into 6.4. But we just are putting, I think that the CJC is kind of putting in this part where it says we would want it in the code, just to emphasize why we think it's important to be in the code, or what elements we think are important to include into the changes of 6.4.
And just to reiterate, those changes are, you want the rights of the accused maintained unless it's not compliant with Title IX.
Yeah.
And sex, you want sexual harassment in the code of conduct.
Yeah, well, it's, we want sexual harassment and sexual abuse in the code of conduct unless it's not compliant and has to be 6.4.
Okay, great. So I hope that's a bit, that makes a bit of sense. If you're still confused, please ask questions, because this is very tricky, and these are discussions that have been happening over the past few months. So first on the speakers is Representative Brown.
Hi, I was going to commend you for doing a really great job with summarizing that, because I know Peter and I went to a bunch of the sessions, and a lot of the material was just, it was just very convoluted and
like over your head, and they just bicker back and forth about stuff that you can't change.
That was really great. I was wondering if you could maybe summarize it in 3 points for everyone, because I feel like everyone's still kind of confused. I know I'm still kind of confused about Resolution 7.
Alright, so I'll try and take out some of the details and just lay it out. Okay, so Title IX, has to do with civil rights laws. Then there's a Dear Colleagues letter that's saying that we have to change the code of conduct in order to comply with Title IX. And in order to do that, it's probably going to have to go into sexual harassment and sexual abuse. Are probably going to have to go into 6.4 so that the standard of evidence can be changed to preponderance of evidence. By changing it to preponderance of evidence, I'll explain that. So clear and convincing is a higher standard of evidence, and that kind of protects the rights of the accused more than the preponderance of evidence. But the Dear Colleague letter is basically saying in order to comply with Title IX, it has to change the preponderance of evidence.
So that makes it easier for you to win a case saying that you were sexually involved.
Yeah.
Do people understand what preponderance of evidence is? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then there's a few other points, and then Resolution 6 is pulling out points that are just going to make it better for women or victim of sexual harassment or sexual abuse to be able to come forward. And then Resolution 7 is giving two options. Either you put it into Code of Conduct with the changes made by Resolution 6, or you put it into 6.4. And it's saying, and Resolution 7 is also saying that we would rather it be in the Code of Conduct, but we understand that the President and the people like advising him may not believe that it's compliant, or won't see it compliant with Title IX, and therefore we're saying we can put it in 6.4, and that if it's put in 6.4, it has 6.4 has to be rewritten with input from the University Assembly.
Yeah, so we'll go down the speakers list, but just again, why wouldn't
I just have sort of a question for you, or maybe if someone else knows. I'm just sort of curious why Cornell is the body that sort of resolves these issues, because they seem pretty serious, and I'm wondering why they're not just handled by the county or the city of Ithaca.
It would be handled by both Cornell and the city or of Ithaca or whatever, but the thing is that you have the code of conduct in place because it's seen as like a right to come to Cornell, and that something has to, if you do something that's against the code of conduct, so there's going to be consequences coming from Cornell as well as from, in this case, as well as from the city of Ithaca.
And
this
is
a
colleague.
Huh?
This is
your
colleague.
Yeah.
Next
on the speakers
list
is Vice
President Finance Nicoletti. So I'm still just trying to understand a few things about this. So first, it seems to me that policy 6.4, which is in the code of conduct, which deals with sexual harassment and
6.4 isn't in the code of conduct.
It's not. Where is that?
it's a policy in itself that is right now currently not applying to students. Yeah.
But it deals with sexual harassment.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is for all people in the university, including undergraduates?
As of now it is.
Well, yeah, if it was changed, if sexual harassment and sexual abuse is taken out of the code of conduct, then it would be put in 6.4, and then 6.4 would deal with students. But right now, policy 6.4 does not deal with students.
Which is why it needs to be changed.
Yeah.
Because if there's nothing protecting students, there needs to be something where students are protected. And since 6.4 does not deal with students, this would be the same change of 6.4.
Okay, got it. So what is uncompliant with, why is 6.4 uncompliant with Title IX?
You mean the code of conduct not compliant with Title IX?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's uncompliant?
Yeah.
Not what you think.
Yeah.
Said that Resolution 6 changed some of that. So what is still uncompliant? Like, what are we talking about?
So what's uncompliant is, okay, so Resolution 6 changes pretty much everything that has to be changed for it to be compliant with Title IX, except for the preponderance of evidence.
So that's the only thing.
Yeah.
And that, and changing it from beyond reasonable doubt or whatever to preponderance of evidence would impact undergraduate cases of accused sexual assault?
Yes, because preponderance of evidence is a lower standard of evidence, so it's easier for the victim or accuser.
And what do we think about the rights of the accused being lessened compared to the rights of the accuser because it's the less lower standard to be.
The Code of Judicial Committee and believes that we don't want to change the preponderance of evidence because that's taking away some of the protection of the rights of the accused. However, we understand that it is seen from the Dear Colleagues letter that that standard of evidence would have to be lowered in order to comply with Title IX.
Okay.
And that's the whole reason why I'm saying that we would rather it be left in the code.
There's a bunch of other changes besides preponderance of evidence, because what the Dear Colleague letter says is that procedures need to be prompt and equitable, and then it elaborates in great detail what prompt and equitable means. And one of them is the preponderance of evidence standard, because it's a more likely than not standard. So it's whoever is more credible. You can't have a standard of evidence that presumes that one party is more credible to begin with than the other one just because of them being accused. There are a bunch of other procedural changes, and actually a lot of those are, I think that those were more the reason why the Code and Judicial Committee didn't recommend changing the code. For one thing, the accused person, if they have a special right, there has to be a reciprocal right for the victim. And this can be problematic in a lot of situations, like the accused person has a right to an attorney to cross-examine witnesses. And so the reciprocal right would now be that the accuser would have to have an attorney.
Title IX?
If you were making the code compliant with Title IX. So there are all these intricate rights in the code that are based on treating the accused person differently from the accuser. And you can't easily just retrofit the code to balance those rights out.
No, yeah, that's right.
All right, next one speaker, this is Representative Zolman.
Can you kind of, I don't know, give us an example of like what the implications for each of these are, and like, I'm kind of understanding the legalese now, but I don't understand the human implications of it and how it would affect specific cases.
Okay, so
like some like real life scenarios.
So if you leave it in the code of conduct, then the rights of the accused are kept the same. But if you put it into 6.4, then the rights of the accused would be, or the protections of the rights of the accused would be lowered. So you wouldn't. So if you were being accused of sexually harassing or sexually abusing someone, then you would have the protections of your rights would be lower in 6.4. So you wouldn't. So it might be easier for the hearing board, or if it's in 6.4, the Office of Workforce Policy and Labor Relations to determine that you are guilty than if you are from the hearing board with the code of conduct.
It's a little bit more.
Yeah.
So the big difference with policy 6.4 is, well, okay, just to step through what happens if you're accused in the campus code of conduct, that's sort of the starting point here, is you have a meeting with the judicial administrator. The judicial administrator does an investigation, and then if they decide that there's a case, if they think that the accused person has done something wrong, in this case a sexual assault or sexual harassment, they have, or if the accused person doesn't agree that they did something wrong, they have a hearing, and a panel of students, staff, and faculty determine what happened and make a factual determination and then make a recommendation about the sanction. And then there's an appeal process for that. In policy 6.4, you have a fact finder who, it sounds like it may actually end up being the judicial administrator still, so we may be talking about the same people carrying out these processes that carry them out now. So who does the investigation doesn't really change. What changes is the procedure around that. So the facts will be determined by this investigator, like the judicial administrator, and then he will recommend a sanction based on that, and then it will go straight to an appeal. So there isn't that hearing step where you have this kind of jury-like group making a factual determination. That's the big procedural change. Some of the other changes are people will be allowed to have advisors as they are in the campus code of conduct, but they're, if you have an attorney representing you, they wouldn't be able to cross-examine witnesses. Instead, they would be able to advise you about what questions to ask, but the questions would be asked by a member of the Cornell community who was representing you.
Okay. And before we go to our next question, so just to clarify, this is a policy that you want to see no matter what, so you're making similar policies in the Code of Conduct and 6.4, but assuming that 6.4 will probably be the one that's compliant with Title IX and with university law, but you're hedging both of your bets and making sure that it's similar policies to both.
Yeah. And so that while 6.4 is being changed, there is something in the Code of Conduct for that. But the changes to the Code of Conduct are not completely changing it to be similar to what 6.4 is or /like would be.
Okay. It's like placeholder.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of history there from last year. The changes that were approved in U.S. Resolution 6, that's the earlier one, are not really aimed at complying with Title IX in the letter of it so much as the spirit of it. Mm-hmm. And they're changes that folks from the Women's Resource Center have been asking for, and other people for many years. And they just deal with making the process less intimidating for victims in general.
Great. Next one speaker, this is Representative Mueller.
I think it might be too late for sort of some of the comments that I have about this, I guess. But, and you can help correct me here because I am speaking kind of off the top about it. But one of the things that sticks out to me, particularly actually about the end of Resolution 6, was it says witnesses shall not see or hear other evidence presented at the hearing, such as any police report, except with hearing board chair in terms to be appropriate. And what sticks out about that about me is that many times the witness is the actual accused person. And as far as I know, it is a constitutional right to know the facts against you in a case. And I see that being problematic. Beyond that, I certainly understand the value in trying to, in the spirit of Title IX, make it more accessible for someone to report a sexual assault or sexual abuse of some kind. But I think that there are other ways to make a victim feel more comfortable. Like, you can hold hearings in different rooms where they never have to see the person they're accusing physically. You know, like, there are lots of other ways to do it rather than just stripping the rights of the accused. And I understand the desire to go from that, like, sort of equitable place that you're talking about and making it more easier for the accuser. But I see in trying to do it systematically rather than just in the spirit of it, it's almost, it seems to be very clearly stripping away a lot of the rights of the person being accused.
Well, when 614 is rewritten, the thing is that we're hoping to put in protections of the rights of the accused. And going off of the last point of Resolution 6, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the victim would know the evidence against them, or the evidence presented against them. The victim and the witness are different, and if they're the same, then the victim would have their rights. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'll just clarify. I think this pertains to witnesses other than the accused person. Because very often you'll have, like, a buddy of the accused person, and...
Yeah, I mean that's all well and good, but I would just I guess my main point is just to like be careful in this, because obviously I can't flip over every piece that you guys are going to go through this, but like, just be careful of like too hastily trying to strip the like basic rights of the person being accused in favor of making it easier for an accuser to feel comfortable coming forward with an accusation of sexual assault. Just because a lot, and again, it's not explicitly written out here, like you said, a lot of it will be happening in the future, but I think the idea is that we need to make sure that like, there are, like, we should be looking at all the legal experts that we have sort of in this. Like, there are very fair ways to make that more comfortable for someone without directly removing the rights of the accused.
So, I mean, that touches on something that's important that might not have been, I think it's one of the most difficult things to tease out of these proposals, but constitutional rights don't really apply to a university because they constrain the power of the government. And the rights you're talking about are from a criminal model of justice, which the idea behind it is to basically sort of tie one of the hands behind the back of the government, which is perceived to be the stronger power when it's taking away people's rights. And one of the issues here that I think has been very challenging for the committee is that in the government's view around Title IX, being a student at a university or an employee of a university is not a right, it's a privilege. So the standards that they require to be applied are civil standards, which are all about balancing rights between two parties who are on equal footing. And that it does challenge a lot of the assumptions about what rights are appropriate.
Thank you. So, if you feel like that's something that you would like to bring up, that's exactly what the Google Doc is for. If you echo those points, please make sure that you say that in your part of the Google Doc as well, just so we can bring all of the feedback to this assembly to the university campus. Next on the speaker list is Trustee Borges.
No, I was going to respond to earlier. Clarifying. It has been clarified, yeah.
Gotcha. Next on the speaker list is Representative Hoffman.
Yeah, I just want to clarify what the penalties are when someone's found guilty of sexual harassment. I guess it would be something like expulsion from the university or some form of a suspension, because when you like talk about, obviously that's something serious for a person that has like lifelong repercussions, and there were boundaries for that happening before. And, you know, when you lower those boundaries, I think that's an important thing to consider, that you don't want, you know, when someone just has to present sort of a, maybe a majority proof, it becomes very easy to, like, maybe walk a little bit more of a fine line.
Yeah, so the sanctions, I don't know what exactly the sanctions are, but as far as I know, they would be determined by the hearing board and by, or in the code of conduct by the hearing board, in 6.4, the fact finder. So I don't have like a direct answer for you. I don't.
They would be talking. The most severe sanction in either of these cases would be suspension or expulsion.
Alright, so we're moving on to our second speaker's list. Is there anyone on the first speaker's list or someone that hasn't spoken yet that would like to ask a question? Alright, moving on to the second speaker's list, Vice President of Finance, Nicholas.
Another follow-up question. If Title IX tells us exactly what we need to do, then what are we discussing? Like, what is the wriggle room? Like, besides, like, okay, we put it here or there, like, what is the actual tangible difference of us discussing this? Because we have to be in compliance, obviously.
because what? So there's Title IX, and then there's a Dear Colleague letter that interprets Title IX and gives guidance as to what needs to be done, but it's not clear cut, this is what you have to do. And a lot of like the wording I know was vague or hard to determine, and so that's what the committee was going through, and that's what was the discussion to figure out what to do exactly.
Well, I can tell you, at the last meeting of the committee, there was a lot of debate about the first point in that resolution, about whether the committee should express a preference for something that counsel's office and the Dear Colleague letter say is not lawful as the first choice. And the committee ultimately decided that it felt strongly enough that that current balance of rights that's in the code is what it would prefer to do unless someone else with the legal expertise and the role in that question says it has to be otherwise. But yeah, that was a question that was raised, and I'm sure it will be asked again at the UA meeting whether it's appropriate to have option one be something that the president's advisors have been pretty clear is not acceptable.
So essentially it says, like, for instance, you need to give equal rights to blah, 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 and appeal, and those are things that isn't, they aren't exactly clear-cut. It's up to us to just determine how equal rights to appeal are given through our process. So that's kind of one of the examples of how we're talking about the gray areas of how we apply it to our system.
Yes, it gives examples, and there's also a letter that the Title IX coordinators at Cornell wrote that basically takes excerpts from that letter, compares them with sections of the code, and explains what compliance issues they see there. So it kind of, there is a document that bridges between the code and the Dear Colleague letter to sort of, you know, help you figure out where the problem issues are.
Is that like that 75-page document you were talking about?
The 19-page OCR letter?
This is it's an April 22nd letter, and I'm sure we could circulate the link to it. But it's about, it's maybe 20 pages.
Are we talking about the new colleague letter?
No, this is...
Can you clarify for everyone what exactly that entails, the new colleague letter?
Yeah, so I guess you have messed on the secret list, so...
Sorry.
Yeah, for Representative Brown.
Sorry. Oh, no, I just want... Because does everyone know what the new colleague letter, and, like, why these issues kind of...
Could you just
sure.
give the initial history, let's back up even further, and
okay.
talk about the new colleague letter?
So there's... a law that Congress passed in late 60s, early 70s, the Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, which requires universities to treat students, I mean everybody in the university, equally on the basis of gender. And it's very brief, not specific. And then that gives authority to the U.S. Department of Education to write more regulations and clarifications about exactly what is entailed in treating people equally. And they periodically also issue what are called guidance documents, which are basically memos in legalistic detail explaining what universities have to do and giving more examples and also giving hints about when they go to enforce the rules and punish institutions that aren't conforming, what they're going to be looking for. The Dear Colleague letter is one of those, and they sent it to every educational institution that receives funding from the federal government in the country. So basically every primary school, secondary school, university, community college got this letter, and then had to decide what does this letter mean for us and how are we going to make sure that we're following it, what it says the law is. And what our university did the campus code is I don't know exactly who it was, but there's a Title IX group, a few coordinators who are experts in Title IX, and there's some people in the counsel's office who are legal experts on this issue, and I guess they got together basically and wrote this letter, which has excerpts of the code and excerpts of the letter and then an explanation of what the compliance issues are, and that's about 20 pages. It's pretty straightforward, but as often happens with these documents, they will highlight what the problem is and then suggest that the group responsible for that policy figure out how to make it conform. And the group responsible in this case is the University Assembly.
Can I do a quick
call?
Yes. Okay, sorry. So, just given that the UA received this ambiguous letter and they've come this far into drafting this resolution and passage of Resolution 6, by us passing Resolution 7 or voting on it, are we just giving our acceptance of it for the UA to then again go through the process that they went through with Resolution 6? Or where do they stand right now?
So,
what will we be doing by voting on this resolution?
Well, you guys aren't exactly voting on the resolution. You guys are discussing it and then like creating a formal response since the university. The University Assembly has not voted on Resolution 7, and then we're going to take your response and then discuss as a University Assembly with whoever else is in the room how, if we want to pass Resolution 7, what changes we want to make to Resolution 7, Resolution 7 would go to the President.
Okay.
Okay, so that's why we're doing the Google Doc. We're submitting our own opinions on this whole process. So whatever feelings you have, I'll be sure to summarize them, and we'll have someone present at the meeting. Next on the speakers list is Representative Eker.
Okay, so I'm just a little confused. So is the reason that we have that 6.4 is proposed because the campus code does not have to comply with Title IX? That's why we have 6.4. Like, why is this just going into campus code? Why is 6.4
an option?
I guess.
Because in order for sexual harassment and sexual abuse to go into the code, and for the president and administration to see it in compliance with Title IX, there would probably have to be extreme changes to the code of conduct affecting the entire code of conduct, which is complex, and there's elements of the code of conduct that we wouldn't want to change based on sexual changes that need to be changed for sexual abuse and sexual harassment, and so that's why those cases dealing with sexual harassment and sexual abuse would go into 6.4.
So. And didn't Mary Beth make it pretty clear that she didn't want to deal with, or her office didn't want to deal with, two different procedures that was in the code?
She said that was not a sustainable practice in the long term, just because, you know, people will get confused if you say this hearing board is going to use this standard, but this hearing board is going to use that standard.
Okay, great. Is there any other questions? You have 2 minutes to wrap up the presentation, what you expect from the student assembly, and what you'd like to get from the student here today.
I'd just like to get a response so that the University Assembly knows the Student Assembly, the students, because you guys are all representing the students' opinion on this, because it is directly affecting the students. And then I just want to emphasize the importance of if sexual harassment and sexual abuse go into 6.4, that it's really important that the University Assembly or somebody from the outside has a say into the changes to 6.4, because we need, because we want to make sure that the protection of the rights of the accused is maintained to the extent that it can be.
Great. So thank you so much.
You.
Before we end today, we're going into executive session where each of you will find a laptop and submit your opinions on this whole process before you leave the church.
Everyone's been shared on the Google Doc already.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for presenting and being back and answering all of our questions. All right, moving on to new business, Resolution 39, Charter for Umbrella Programming Fund. I'm removing myself as a sponsor, or not right now. Adam Nicoletti is on the outside, and adding Adam Gillen as another sponsor. Alright, so you have 2 minutes to present. I'm opening up a speaker's list about the essay resolution number 39, Charter for the Umbrella Program.
Okay. So we're presenting Resolution 39. Thank you, Roniel, who drafted this up. So basically, this is a follow-up and a response to some of the discussions that we had at the end of the fall with respect to multicultural community funding, and specifically what we passed with regards to Alana's byline funding allocation, adding at least $1.50 towards the creation of an umbrella programming fund, UPF. So basically, because the Student Assembly has authority and the responsibility to approve changes to byline funded organization charters, and the UPF is going to be inserted into Alana's charter, we are coming to the Student Assembly on behalf of Alana and the UPF to formally approve the introduction of the UPF into the charter of Alana. So I want to, before we start, I transmitted this to Natalie, but I'd like to strike the second whereas clause. It is friendly from the sponsors. And in the fourth whereas clause, which not all the organizations would be large enough to apply for, strike that as well. The rest of it is good. So if you want to talk about
So I guess just going into like where this is derived from and where the logic was and kind of how the process has unfolded. So as many of you remember, hopefully all of you remember, CAPSU submitted a byline funded application last semester. They were approved as a byline funded organization, but were not given an allocation. And really the kind of background for that was delineation between groups in the multicultural community, whether or not it was appropriate to have, among many other things, one of the larger umbrella organizations be byline funded when some of the other ones didn't have that opportunity because of their size or just their population on campus. So this was kind of the perfect middle ground for, the SA and for all of those organizations. So in essence, what's going to happen is instead of, those groups having to go to the SAFC every semester, then submitting special requests to Alana, See You Tonight, and all of them, we felt that those extra requests to byline-funded organizations such as See You Tonight or departments were ways that those organizations could specifically further their own progress. But in terms of getting money from Alana or the SAFC, those were sustainable developments that they should get on a semester-to-semester and more importantly, year-to-year basis. So what the UPF does is it provides them with that direct funding through the SAF directly. So every year, a certain portion of Alana's byline-funded allocation, this year it was $2? That we decided to give them?
I don't know if it's been decided yet exactly how much will Alana chunk out.
Right, so
at least $1.50.
At least $1.50, that's the number I was looking for. So at least $1.50 will be going towards the UPF, potentially more, and then the umbrella organizations themselves will have the autonomy to decide how that money is divided amongst those specific groups in a way that they feel most appropriate. So that meeting is actually happening this week. I did want to kind of emphasize, I know Vice President Nicoletti talked about we as the Student Assembly have the power to change a byline-funded organization's charter. Alana is a member of the UPF committee, and this charter, the one that you see before you, passed unanimously among all of their members by a vote of 10-0. So I don't think it's we're like going in there and kind of unilaterally making this change. This was more of a process that we handed over to the umbrella organizations. They took upon themselves, and we're kind of just helping them execute the process now that they've developed it.
I don't know if there's anything else we want to talk
just
about.
To add two things. One, because these umbrella organizations will no longer apply to the SAFC for funding, we'll also will relieve a little pressure on the SAFC, and we'll leave more money there to go around, especially as the SAFC moves forward with more changes. And also, secondly, it's just a commitment of the Student Assembly going forward, sort of part of the long-term agenda that we're going to stay involved with the multicultural community and remain reaching out to all the different organizations and communities on campus.
I guess the very last thing I remembered as a very last quick note, if you take a look at the chart, you'll realize that a Student Assembly member is a member of the UPF committee, but they are non-voting. And I think that has a certain kind of epitomization to it in the essence that we have helped them create this process, and we're going to help them oversee it moving forward. And like Vice President Gitlin said, we want to maintain communications with those groups. But this is really emphasizing the fact that this is a process that they now have ownership over and will be able to take part in on their own.
It's in new business. Sorry to cut you off.
That's all right.
It's in new business, so we are only discussing this week. So that's maybe questions and no comments. So all questions, unless you want to visit the business of the day, can be.
Motion of business of the day.
All right. If there's been a motion of business of the day, is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Is there a dissent? Okay. So there's been dissent. Let's begin at new business. So today is only going to be questions for the essay resolution number 39. So first on the speaker list is Representative Mueller.
I would like to make a comment.
All right. Next on the speaker's list is Vice President Outreach.
Point of question to the chair. We're okay with hearing comments if you guys want to like suggest changes.
Yeah, and comments are fine. So.
I just want to say that I think this is very valuable from speaking with different members of the multicultural community, because one of the things that this does is, because by giving them more ownership over the programming that they're doing here, and by where the funds are going, it promotes more intercultural programming rather than just intercultural programming, because the money is all coming, like they're not buying for all these different grants and stuff like that and thinking that they really need to keep their money to themselves. Because it's all coming from the umbrella fund here, it's a lot easier to have a way for them to do intercultural programming and actually creating that unifying community of many different diverse students that we keep talking about wanting to have.
Vice President Outreach, Vice.
Do you guys think that this plan will sufficiently prevent umbrella org from applying for violent funding in the future? Should we expect that not to happen in the next allocation funding cycle?
So I guess an expectation of entering into this structure would be that this would be the process, the way that you would get a guaranteed allocation, and it would somewhat replace the Alana allocations that these groups got. It hasn't been exactly decided what other funding sources groups that accept UPF funding will not be allowed to apply for, but it's at least at this point, sure, not Alana, because this is kind of replacing that as well. So to answer your question, no. Unless, you know, the groups are kind of just doing this for, you know, just they like spending time in meetings.
Yeah. But we're hoping that because it's cemented within Alana, if they need to grow, Alana allocation can also grow.
Yeah.
So next on the speaker's list is the Vice President of Public Relations, Jerry Downey.
All right, so this is a question. I've read through this a couple times. I didn't find it. I'm not a fan of really putting teeth, you know, like restrictions rather into e-documents like this. But I was wondering if there are any restrictions to prevent, organizations or sub-organizations under, under the main parts of the UPF from applying or, getting funds from here and then going to SAFC and then to other violence. Like, because the idea behind this, I think, something you guys alluded to was to prevent, to have some bit more money in the SAFC to go around as well. And I was wondering if that is just, we're just hoping that's going to happen, or if we're making sure that happens.
So I'm just going to clarify exactly how much money from the SAFC all these four groups get. And then Roniel can talk about Article 6, Section 5, which talks about adding new groups to the UPF. These groups, so LAL does not get any money from the SAFC, except for this semester got a little bit. BSU never gets money from the SAFC. They always get a lot of co-sponsorships from other departments. NASAC gets sometimes a large chunk, and then CAPSU, what is something like that? I think they always got like admins. Or was it? I guess now it's different because of cohorts. Anyway, so that's not really as much a concern as much as the Alana and making sure they have a place to get consistent funding.
Yeah, I think what you were talking about was like them, like CAPSU getting money and then giving that to an organization under their umbrella who then goes and gets money from the SAFC for the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the money, like we're at the meeting that we're having this week is taking a look at what the actual budgets of these organizations are and then supplementing expenses in those budgets, like for the internal umbrella org, not for their umbrella communities. And like, if you look at the specific line is the last line of Article 2 for purpose, the UPF should not be expected to serve as the sole funding for any one umbrella org. And I can guarantee you that it won't. like, in no way, shape, or form is there going to be enough money in the UPF to cover all of the expenses for CAPSU or BSU, and they're going to have to work outside of their normal means right now, just like they do outside of the SAFC and Alana, to get co-sponsorships from other departments and stuff like that. So, like, while it would technically be possible to do what you're talking about, it doesn't make sense to me since they're already constrained for funding. And I think that all these umbrella orgs, like, value the impact they bring and would want to fund their own expenses first.
I agree with that completely. I think you make sense there. But my concern there is just more of a closing comment. It's just that if they still are faced with, you know, all these organizations still faced with this kind of a document maze, what's to stop someone spinning off and saying, all right, file lines for me. You know?
Wait, sorry, yeah. Just clarify what you mean by document maze.
Like, if they have, I mean, if they have to go, okay, they're going to go to UPF to get money, the FDSC, departments, and all that stuff that, you know, they complained about doing earlier, every single one of those organizations complained about that. So it's still very, it's, you know, just looking forward. I think that's what
I'm saying. Can I motion to extend time? Okay. So I think what you were kind of alluding at is, like, if this is what they're going to have to deal with, why wouldn't they just become a bylaw-funded organization next time around?
I agree with that, yeah.
So, I mean, I think the reason why they wouldn't, at least in the conversations that we've had, is that, A, you know, like, realistically, LAL and NASAC do not have the size or the population on campus to become bylaw-funded organizations. Like, it's completely out of the question. And then as far as BSU and CAPSU go, but, like, being a bylaw-funded organization means that you're asking for enough money out of the student activity fee to fund your operations. And in that line of mind, it just doesn't make sense for them to do that outside of the constraints of the UPF when the UPF can give them everything they need to do that. So, like, in essence, like, the document maze you were talking about, like, they don't have to apply for SAFC anymore. They don't have to apply for Alana anymore. It's just UPF and then external money they get from departments and stuff, and that's just, like, you know, like, icing on top of the cake. So at the end of the day, we do think this cuts down that maze.
It definitely does.
So two things also. Either, you know, we're going to start having a conversation this semester, and I'm sure this is going to be going on next semester, talking about reforming eligibility requirements for bylaw-funded organizations and clarifying exactly what we mean by that. I think the UPF has also provided this precedent of this is where umbrella organizations are going to receive funding. And I think it takes a lot of the question out if next time an organization similar to a CAPSU were to want to apply for funding, because this is the precedent that we've set. So hopefully we'll start to address those concerns and the next assembly will do that as well. I think one of the major concerns that we have moving forward is how to manage conflicts between the groups when deciding how much each will get out of the UPF. And unfortunately, any structure you have where you're dividing money between groups, you're always going to have conflicts. So I think once we figure out exactly percentage-wise how much each group will get from the UPF, that a big problem will be tackled, where you won't have to deal with it for another, you know, two whatever amount of years. So, you know, the committee is trying to deal with that right now, and there's different proposals on the table. So some are saying, let's do it all by what percentage of the multicultural community is your population, how much money is your total budget. So there's a lot of different proposals out there. My guess and our guess is that the final one will be a combination of all those factors into some kind of a point system, which CAPSU proposed kind of a you know, system like that.
Yeah. And just to clarify on that, like, that's, am I done?
Yeah, that's
nice. Yes.
Next one speaker is Representative Brown.
Yeah, Nicola, you basically just answered my question. The biggest issue I saw with this is that I know there's tensions among a lot of these groups, and when you add in money and finances and just really distributing it to the each organization, I can see risk. And another reason is because there's a different population of all these minority groups per year. Like, this year it's like 11% Black population in freshman class versus like 3% Asian in my class. So, like, if you just add the increase in numbers to each group, that could also raise funds for the future, I'm thinking. And if there's another 11% increase next year, that's, like, double the population, maybe double the membership of BSU, you know? So, I don't know if this would be a long-term fix. I think it's an awesome proposal, and I'm really glad that you guys are addressing it. I think if you can work out how the funds will be distributed to
lessen the tensions between the groups, then it'd be a really good position.
Yes, this is exactly what I wanted to talk about at the end of the last statement. So I'm actually on like collecting proposals and budgets from the groups right now, and I've seen what a lot of them do have to say about like how to divide the money. I think the first thing that everyone on the SA has to remember is that, you know, aside from like an SAFC appeal or a byline funded allocation where we all by majority vote will decide how much a group gets, that's absolutely not the case here. We're deciding how much the pool is, and the groups themselves have complete autonomy as far as deciding how to divide that. So the way that it's kind of structured is in every off year, they would decide the actual allocation split for the next year. So I don't know if that addresses your volatility in student population issue, but more importantly, like, A, because it is a two-thirds vote, like, it is something where, like, every time, like, the next class of officers comes in, they can, like, completely overhaul the system and be like, this is how we want to split up money now, or, you know, like, if three of the groups are very large and two of them are small, then they can flip it like that. Also, you know, because Alana is one of the voting bodies in this organization, and they're supposed to kind of represent kind of the culmination of groups on campus, we kind of see them as a more objective sense, so you wouldn't have it be possible for, you know, hypothetically saying like BSU and CAPSU, which are two of the very large organizations, at least population-wise, to come in and say, we want the UPF allocation split to be explicitly decided by population on campus, and then LAL and NASAC, which are very small, kind of just get outvoted in that. Alana would have that kind of like fifth body arbitrator to say we represent everyone, that's not fair.
Between LAL,
BSU, and right, so, I mean...
Yeah,
I mean, like, you don't want to add, like, fuel to the fire type of thing. At least from what I've seen, like, obviously we can't count on, like, all leaders being like this in the future, but I think the leaders of these umbrella organizations are kind of seeing past, like, you know, tensions between the community and are more looking at, like, improving the overall social welfare of their constituency. I think we've definitely seen that over the last couple collaborative meetings. I think they're going to be able to put a procedure in that will last for a couple of years, and you know, in a couple of years' time, if they have to come back and revisit it, I think they will be able to efficiently do so.
Okay. That was basically the biggest conversation of whether that was the biggest problem to begin with. Are we going to start talking to a lot of students that all are looking at this one sum of money and want to distribute them, and do we as a collective group think that they can do it? And our answer is yes, you can do it, and it's a tough conversation, but you're an organization that needs this money and needs to not be passing the hat around. So this is a streamlined way of getting funding, and we believe in your organization, and we're here to help you out. Give us your budget, let's have a conversation. And we all believe in this collaborative method, and that's why this organization. Just to clarify, we haven't decided how any of this money is going to be distributed. This is for the umbrella organizations themselves to decide. So this is the charter that they ratified themselves at our last meeting. And this is going to give them the authority to be able to do this. It's basically happening anyway. This was kind of just a formality that we wanted to have through the student assembly. So just to give you context and I guess follow up on where our conversations came from, CAPSU. Next on the speakers list is Representative Meller. And we're shortening speaking time to 10 minutes.
Okay. Pretty much, I mean, you guys have been covering this, but just in general, like, it seems like since every group has the same objective, they all want to get, you know, as much funding as possible for their own, you know, respective organizations. Like, it seems like it's just, like, that's just a recipe for this whole thing becoming very cutthroat, and it seems to me like it's necessary to have a third party that's making this decision. And you can always hope that, like, these representatives are going to be mature and, I don't know, somehow do it democratically, but I feel like practically it's not necessarily going to work out.
So that's a good point. I'm really glad that we're focusing on how we're going to manage conflicts here. There are two ways to step back. You got a pool of money. Everyone wants the pool money, and everyone's going to fight over the pool money no matter how it's divided. And you have two ways you can figure out how the money is going to be divided. Either somebody on the side says, this is how it's going to happen. Everyone who's going to get the money is basically like, well, you're arbitrary and you're wrong, and we're all going to fight against what you say. Or we give it to the groups who are going to get the money to decide it amongst themselves, but then they're going to fight. So either way, I think you're going to have conflict there. you know, we put it to the umbrella groups and we said, which way would you like to be, which way would you like it? And they said, we want to have control over the way that we're going to receive funding. So what we're looking for in terms of the UPF is a way to take out the politics involved in making these decisions. So finding objective ways to incorporate how to do the percentages is going to be the best way, because that leaves less subjectivity for the groups to determine. In terms of the makeup of the voting members of the UPF, they're all going to be the four umbrella groups, Alana, and then one member of the SA, and there's also going to be a member of the administration there to equalize some of the discussion and keep it on point, and also kind of have that historical accuracy there as well. But it's something that we're continuing to think about, and if you can think of any procedural ways we can take the politics out of the discussion and make it more objective, we would definitely really appreciate that.
Yeah, so one thing I feel a little unclear to me, and maybe you said that they're not expecting to get all their funding from just the UPF, but you also said that it's going to maybe alleviate a little bit or make more room for SASC funding, and I'm just curious, my first question is what's preventing these groups from applying to SASC for funding, and why aren't they if they aren't? I'm a little curious about. And also, a second question on top of that, unrelated, is are these being reviewed annually? The UPF is going to be distributed or decided on annually, right? So if a new group wants to join, I know there's something in here about you can make an amendment and add a new umbrella organization. Does that mean they have to wait until the next year to get tacked on?
Sure. So I guess a couple of points you brought up there. So right now, all of these groups are getting SASC funding. When Vice President Gitlin said they wouldn't be getting it would alleviate SASC funding. The small amount of funding they are getting would no longer be coming out of the SAFC. It would be coming out of Alana next year through the UPF, because that's where UPF money provides. It was an assumed stipulation that groups that are in the UPF would not be getting SAFC funding. We forgot to include it in the original charter. We'll be amending it at the next meeting, but that's already been explicitly agreed upon by the groups. If you want it in writing, we'll be happy to do that. The next statement about the yearly thing, so I guess just to go into like how the UPF would be allocated, it works just like a byline funded organization. So in odd numbered years, like 2011, when we're byline funded, they're actually going through the byline funding process. Alana would have the application. Alana would get their funding. In the even numbered years, they would discuss how to split the next year's money, which would then apply for the next 2 years. So like in this coming year, like right now basically in 2012, they're going to be deciding how, once they get the next byline funding cycle, how they want to split that up, and how the pool of money that that Vice President Nicoletti talked about would be divided among the umbrella orgs. So if a new umbrella org were to want to join using Section 5 of Article 6, then they would do it just like the groups are doing right now, where they would continue to apply for SAFC funding. If they were approved as a member of the UPF, then during the cycle which they began getting funds from the UPF, they would no longer get money from the SAFC. I don't know if that makes sense, sir.
No, it is.
Yeah, just to elaborate a little bit, I should have been a little more precise when I was speaking earlier. It's likely that they wouldn't go to the SAFC. It's not in here. I should have been more explicit
that's
about
what
that.
We on.
No,
so
you're
we,
not.
But, so it will be next week. Right. We just don't have it in the charter, but that was a good catch. So we'll
that they won't.
They for sure will not be getting SAFC money.
Can't.
Yeah.
We already talked to them, and it was an agreement since we've been having monthly meetings. That you, this would substitute SAFC and a lot of direct funding, and Dr. Renee Alexander has opened up a separate fund for intercultural planning between the organizations. So we've kind of, it's already been agreed upon. We're not saying anything differently than what the members and the leaders of every single umbrella organization has already agreed upon and explicitly said and what they wanted to see happen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to give you support for the fact that that's true, like when we're looking at budgets right now, we have them pool their money into money they got from the SAFC and money they got from elsewhere, so we could look at what money they would have to replace in the UPF. Like, that's a very explicit assumption in the group.
Next one, speaker, those are Representative
Scalfo. I just have a quick question. When I was reading this over earlier, in the part where it discusses meetings, and it says the committee will be expected to discuss to meet to discuss how funds allocated that year should be divided among their respective groups. When they discuss that, is that for the coming 2 years or only for the next year?
Coming 2 years.
Okay.
And I don't know whether the structure states whether that it needs to be renewed every 2 years or not. I don't think so. I think it's just if they come and they want to change it, they can do that. So they just have to come together and say, this is how much we want to.
But it's for the next 2 years, right?
Yeah.
I would say because SAF allocations are for two, it's a two-year allocation, so you're dividing that money 2 years.
It's probably better to reduce the amount of time that you're going to meet and talk about this issue to reduce, like Avi said, the politics that are involved in the decision-making.
All right, anyone else on the first speaker's list? Seeing none, we're moving on to the second speaker's list, Representative Goldberg.
So my only, I guess, concern, and I don't have any clear solution for this, is just, again, if there's a new umbrella organization that feels that should get UPS funding, should join this funding group, that they have to wait 2 years. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because this isn't byline funding. Yeah, I understand that they have to sort of follow in the shadow of byline funding because that's where their money is technically coming from. But because it isn't byline funding, I mean, any other group applies yearly, annually. If they want to start something, then they can do it on the next year. So I'm just kind of wondering what you guys think about that.
So if a new umbrella org were to start, then that first semester, like they wouldn't even have to wait a year, that next semester they could get money from the SAFC. This isn't saying that every umbrella organization on campus has to get funded through the UPF.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying that these five explicit members will make up this committee and those four explicit umbrella orgs will get money through the UPF. If a new umbrella organization, I can't even think of one off the top of my head, but like if a new continent were to be discovered and those students came here and they wanted to make up an umbrella organization, they could start a club and they could get SAFC funding next semester. And then they could apply to join the UPF at any point during the 2 years and then would be getting a slice of the UPF starting at the next byline funding cycle in 2014, just like any other organization on campus.
Yeah, basically, to just clarify, this isn't something that we expect a lot of groups to be shooting applications for. This is mainly for these four organizations that have been around for a while and have kind of shown themselves as to be the representative bodies of these, these groups in the multicultural community. And if there is a prominent umbrella organization that is being left out, it probably has been around for a number of years and would be prominent enough to make plans that would allow it to kind of go into this structure every 2 years.
Okay.
To talk about that. And the UPF is supposed to grow as Alana grows, so we'll probably, in Appendix B, which will hopefully come on the agenda next week, will be set at a percentage of Alana's allocation, so whatever they decide UPF is, 20%, I don't know what it is, it will be said that 20% of this allocation shall be reserved for the umbrella programming fund. And so if Alana's grows, it automatically grows by, obviously, according to that.
All right, that's the end of the speakers list. I'm ending this meeting. We'll come back to Resolution 39 next week, and hopefully
Appendix B.
Appendix B, thank you.
Yeah.
We'll be discussing that week as well.
And just one, if I'm going to be sending out kind of things about Appendix B. If you are communicating with a group that has expressed concern over certain things in there, please bring them to me. I'm going to be revising it, and it's going to be kind of a two, potentially three-week process.
You definitely have to have the calendar committee is coming to talk about next week. There have been a lot of big changes that are going to be coming down the road. So Jeffrey and I have been drafting an email explaining the changes from the student perspective. You'll get all the documents beforehand as well. So come prepared. If you haven't answered the Google Docs, we have a bank of computers up front for your handy use. You're not allowed to leave the room unless you give me some of your feedback. So have a good night, guys, and we'll see you all later.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.